I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Healthcare workers today are trying to trace potential contacts of Dr. Craig Spencer, who has the first confirmed case of Ebola in New York City. Complicating matters is the fact that Dr. Spencer took the subway the night before he was admitted to the hospital. Maryland officials, meanwhile, have issued new directives about Ebola should someone here contract the disease. Two Baltimore hospitals have been designated to receive Ebola patients in Maryland. Also, new federal guidelines have been issued related to travelers coming into the country from West Africa. Dr. John Smarr, Midday contributor and a specialist in infectious diseases at Sinai Hospital, Baltimore, continues our coverage of Ebola on Midday after the news from NPR.
Ebola right now can spread fear just by the sound of the word. Ebola is not an airborne illness. It is contracted when a person is extremely ill and symptomatic, and is basically contracted through the bodily fluids. I know it's a frightening situation. I know when you watched it on the news and it was about Dallas, it was frightening. That it's here in New York, it's more frightening. New York is a dense place, a lot of people on top of each other. But the more facts you know, the less frightening the situation is.
That was New York Governor Andrew Cuomo addressing the public last night regarding New York City's first confirmed case of the Ebola virus. This is Dan Rodericks. Welcome to Midday Friday, everyone. Dr. Craig Spencer, a Doctors Without Borders physician, just back from Guinea, tested positive for Ebola and is in isolation at a New York City hospital. Mayor Bill de Blasio is urging New Yorkers not to be alarmed also. Meanwhile, healthcare workers are in a race to find people who might have come into close contact with Dr. Spencer, who the night before had gone to a bowling alley via subway. Here in Maryland, health officials have designated three hospitals to receive Ebola patients should anyone here contract the disease. Those hospitals include Johns Hopkins and the University of Maryland Medical Center. Changing course from previous plans following news that the virus had infected two nurses in Texas. And speaking of those nurses, the news of just the last half hour or so, the Dallas nurse Nina Pham, who became the first person to contract Ebola in the U.S. While treating the late Thomas Eric Duncan, is now free of the virus. She was treated for Ebola at the National Institutes of Health here in Maryland in Bethesda. And starting just this week, one other thing, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued new rules for travelers coming into the country from West Africa. Those travelers are now required to take their temperature daily and to report to local health officials for 3 weeks. They will also be asked for contact information and may face travel restrictions. That starts on Monday. Maryland is among six states being asked to increase surveillance because of the larger number of travelers coming into the state from those countries. During this hour of the show, we'll be looking at the U.S. response to the Ebola outbreak, and we'll also look at how effective attempts to control the virus in Africa have been. Later on, Elizabeth Sirlamitzos, I have to get that right by the time she gets on the air with us. Elizabeth Sirlamitzos, who is in Liberia, she's a staffer with the Johns Hopkins Center for Communication Programs. We're going to hear about that program, what exactly it is. It's part of the Bloomberg School of Public Health. That program works to combat fear in the hardest hit communities through messaging and education, basically trying to establish better public health communication systems in Liberia. So Elizabeth Sirlamitzos will be with us later on in this hour. We start our show again with Dr. John Smarr, Assistant Director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Baltimore's Sinai Hospital, and he's the Program Director of the Internal Medicine Residency Program at Sinai. Back with us, regular Midday contributor, our doctor in residence. Nice to have you back with us, John.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
That's good news about Nina Pham being found Ebola-free, I assume, from a blood test today.
Yeah, absolutely. This is outstanding news, and it's interesting because now that we're actually seeing people who are successfully living through this. And of course, that's something that already happens. Plenty of folks over, even though we hear about the death toll in Africa, plenty of folks there have lived through it. But here, sort of, it brings up that the idea of the process. What do they go through in terms of trying to declare someone Ebola free? And in her case, and what the CDC does, is that there are tests that are done that they can actually measure the level of virus that's in your blood. And so when those go away, when those come back as negative, then that's when you can say, okay, this person no longer has the virus in their blood, so it's no longer in their system. And usually people are already feeling much better by that point. It's not like for the most part that there are very sick people who they're constantly checking to see how this. This is sort of like the final certification, and this is absolutely stellar news.
How would you assume she was treated at NIH?
So everybody who has Ebola is given the key cornerstone of the fact is that they get supportive care, aggressive supportive care. You're losing tons of fluids when you're at your sickest over the course of a day. Some people would say 5-10 liters of fluids or more. And so the keys, of course, are IV fluids, making sure your electrolytes are fine, making sure kidney function, all these other supportive things. But of course, with our own resources, what people have been interested in is, are we able to do anything investigational? And what's been done more recently with some individuals, such as the nurse Nina Pham, is that the idea of, well, we had this drug, this ZMAP thing that we talked about a couple of months ago that some people received. And in fact, the folks who came back originally,
the American doctors.
Exactly. That's what they received. And then that drug, there was only a very limited supply and it disappeared. And so that's been a big part of the problem. The Dallas patient, he received a drug that is sort of experimental in the sense that we already have it, but using it to try to treat Ebola is an experimental thing. And it is very unclear whether or not it had anything to do with what his very unfortunate outcome was. But the newer thing that people are doing, and it harkens back to what this original ZMAP thing is the idea of giving antibodies from someone who has lived through Ebola in an attempt to, I'm not going to use the phrase boost your immunity. Some people have said that, but essentially to give you a specific immunity, because one of the problems that folks who have Ebola are encountered is that the virus hides a little bit from the immune system. It's harder for your own immune system to make antibodies to the virus. And so if you have antibodies from someone else who's already lived through it, and you're able to give that and infuse someone with those antibodies, then hoping that that is going to help them deal better with the illness. So in her case, Dr. Kent Brantley actually specifically came and gave blood. He was one of the healthcare providers.
One of the
providers.
First two doctors who was treated at Emory.
Precisely. Right. And so he lived through it. And so that's been a thing that people have been talking about, is using his blood, isolating those antibodies, and giving her the serum or the components of the blood that contain the antibodies to help her treat that. And it's also thought that one of the reasons that she was transferred to the NIH was that it would be easier then for people to get samples of her blood and try to maybe make a stockpile or use that towards building a pool of antibodies or serum from patients who have lived, so that we can give that option to other patients who are now getting sick. And of course, there's the physician in New York now. So I can only expect that's in the thought process of the people taking care of him.
Well, Dr. John Smarr is with us in this hour of Midday on Health on Midday Friday. Please feel free to give us a ring, ask a question, anything that's on your mind with regard to Ebola. 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance for the Midday Show at WYPR is 866-661-9309. And also our email address, you can address a question that way, midday@wypr.org. Now I want to ask you a question, Dr. John Smarr, about Dr. Craig Spencer, an emergency doctor who had recently returned from Guinea. And is in New York City now and has been diagnosed to have contracted the virus Ebola. I was thinking this morning about you and doing this show with you today, and I was going to ask you this question. If you had been in Guinea or Liberia or Sierra Leone, if you worked for Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders, and you came back to Baltimore or New York City or Philly, you lived in one of those places, How would you behave? What would you have done personally returning to your home after treating people in those countries or one of those countries for Ebola?
That is an outstandingly good question, Dan.
Well,
Thank you for asking.
I had to ask you that.
And it's a big thing that all of us are thinking about, because any of us who are working at a hospital, like for myself at Sinai, as part of our preparations, whenever you're preparing for an eventuality of something like this, also hoping it never comes to pass, but being ready when it, if it should, this is one of the things that goes through your mind. And so certainly people are publicly being very critical some in some areas of saying, well, this fella, he came back, he was taking his temperatures as he should have been, and that's why he was able to sort of recognize his symptoms and immediately present himself for care, and specifically went to Bellevue Hospital in New York, which is one of the ones that has been designated to be a potential Ebola care site in New York. But the questions of he was riding public transportation, he went bowling,
in
things
Brooklyn,
like that
yeah.
in Brooklyn. And so is that something that was, quote unquote, the right thing for him to do? My answer is predicated on two things. From the science standpoint, the likelihood that he would have been able to infect someone is so infinitesimally low, given on what we know about how he was feeling, et cetera, is that is to the point where there's no reason why if somebody's not having symptoms that they can't go about and engage in their normal daily activities. For instance, the Dallas patient, all of his close contacts, there was that 2.5-ish day period where he had been identified in the ER, then went back out in the community. None of those people have become positive for Ebola, and that is to be expected based on what we know about the virus. However, that's not what we're dealing with in some sense, because we're also dealing with managing people's expectations. We're dealing with a level of concern and hype and fear to the point where contacts of people who even had a rumored contact with someone who had Ebola, there's a bit of discrimination going on, like people who even the fact that they worked at that hospital in Texas, whether or not they had nothing to do with the care of the patient, even now if it's after the 21-day window, still there are issues with I don't want your kid to come to my school,
yeah.
for instance.
Yeah.
And there is zero risk there, and that is truly a level of extreme sort of paranoia. But it's a very real thing. And if Ebola were to come into this community, as opposed to it being flown here to the NIH, for instance, then I think that that I would keep that in mind. And so, for instance, if I were in this situation, because of that and because of what I know, I kind of think that I would be staying home, that I wouldn't be going out to do these things until the 21
would
days.
Would you go to work at Sinai?
I would have that discussion actually with folks
staff,
at Sinai. Because
yeah.
again, like I said, there's the chances of the risk when you're asymptomatic, it's essentially zero from what we've seen. And now we've got a great experience.
And for the record, the
yeah.
only way we know so far that it can mm-hmm. be passed from one individual to another is
by bodily fluid contact. So the worst thing would be if somebody has a wet cough, and so you could conceivably pass it by droplets that spray out a few feet away,
mm-hmm.
Sweat,
vomit.
Stool, vomit, yep, all
right.
the gross bodily fluids,
yep.
that's
Blood.
How you get it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also something, you know, I've even talked about with my own family, because, you know, being an infectious diseases person in Sinai, I'm involved in our Ebola preparations over these last few weeks. And so even my wife has mentioned, you know what, if you were to even get a patient at that hospital, ignoring the fact of whether or not you took care of them, then she would be considering staying home to avoid spreading that potential fear to those at her workplace and other social contacts and things like that. So as much as I think objectively it's kind of ridiculous, and it really is because it goes against what we know about how this virus works, from a realistic and practical standpoint, it would make sense to me to voluntarily sort of self-quarantine to make everyone feel better.
To make maybe take 3 weeks at home.
Right.
21 days
for
the record, because
exactly.
that's the incubation period.
Exactly.
Right?
And then you get into interesting things. For instance, what are employers going to, how would they necessarily view that. So some places, and this is a big discussion in hospitals preparing for potential Ebola patients, is what if we get someone and we take care of them? Then what happens to employees at the hospital who then took care of that patient? Do they really want to go home? And the answer to that very likely is no, because they would fear for potentially the off chance that they could, you don't want to transmit it, of course, to your family, to your loved ones, to your friends. And so many places are deciding to, okay, we need to do the best thing for the patient, but we need to make sure that these employees who did their job are feeling safe and protected in this situation. So they're identifying places where those folks could live, maybe even at the hospital for that 21-day period. And that shouldn't be unpaid leave. That should be paid leave. Right. But of course, different hospitals in different areas are having different flavors of this discussion right now. But these are very important sort of consequences to think about that are downstream that we haven't even really gotten to yet.
Dr. John Smarr, a specialist in infectious diseases, Midday's On Health contributor, with us for the hour, 410-662-8780. We're going to take a quick break, and I promise to get to our phone calls and questions when we get back. Welcome back to Midday on Health. Dan Rodericks with Dr. John Smarr from Sinai Hospital. Would the good doctor agree that apparently Ebola isn't terribly contagious until someone is in the end stages of the virus? A question from Jeff.
I would word it differently, but I think the theme of that is yes. And again, I point to the experience in Dallas. Again, the mode of spread is from body fluids. And when someone is very critically ill, that's when their body is losing control of its ability to clot blood regularly. So you're having these hemorrhagic manifestations, you're having all the fluids going everywhere. And that does correlate to the highest amount of the virus being in your system. So when someone shows up on the first day, if they have a fever, if they're not making any body fluid and you're not exposed to it, then the chances of you getting it would be low. And also, likely, the levels of the virus in your system aren't as ramped up yet. So when someone is in a critical illness stage, that is the riskiest time for them.
Let's take another call. This is Scott in Baltimore. You're on with Dr. Smarr. Go right ahead, Scott.
Hi. I was listening to what you were speaking about. Certainly, those employees that have to be quarantined should be paid as a cost of their job. I think that there is a discomfort in the public whether they're being told the truth of how insidious and how dangerous the situation is, not because necessarily the professionals know, but because they may not know that this thing may be mutating, this thing may be changing. It may be way worse than anybody is discussing.
Okay, Scott, let's hear from Dr. Smarr on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Scott. That's a very important thing. And not to get a little philosophical, but, you know, we're living in sort of a postmodern era, especially with our access to media. And so it's hard in general for the lay public, I think, sometimes to engage and trust and say, government, or even with things like the CDC. And, you know, we've seen this over the last couple of weeks with folks even being critical of that, and you hear different voices, and it's very challenging to sort of parse that out as a lay person who's just hearing these things. How much of this should I believe? But I hear this other person who's saying, oh, maybe Ebola could mutate and become airborne. I have no idea how much credence I should lend to that. Is there something that we're not being told because this other article is a little bit different? And so back to Scott, to your point, is the fact that that's why I'm saying is that part of this is we have to be conscious of this public perception and environment with how Dan, you or I, even talking on the street about Ebola, are thinking. Mm-hmm. And so when people are erring on the side of having fear, and which is totally human, and erring on the side of being very conservative, I think that we as good healthcare stewards should also err on the side of that And of course, we should be protected by our employers. That seems to be a reasonable thing to consider, so that we can do that, because that's in the service of sort of that. That's one way to serve people, serve our patients and our communities and peers.
And explain as best you can based on what you know. And based on what you know, what we know about the virus that was discovered in the 1970s, it seems to be behaving the way it has historically behaved so far, right?
That is correct. And you bring up a point, and I know you just saw me make a very sort of exasperated kind of a look, but that's not a negative. It's a positive in the sense that it is so key for communication, for accurate communication, and for frequent communication and transparency in this type of a situation, be it in general for the media, in general for education, specifically at a place of work. And to your point, yes, there's nothing unexpected about what we're seeing in terms of what we know about how the types of Ebola viruses work. The key thing is that this was sort of the perfect storm of circumstances to become a massive outbreak. It is not that the virus is behaving very, very differently than what we would expect. There were social factors and other factors at play with how this outbreak got completely out of control, why it is still out of control, and why now there is this worldwide potential risk.
Another call for Dr. Smar in Towson. This is Doug. Thank you for calling Midday.
Hi, Dr. Smar. I was trying to understand the mechanism that this this virus occurs. Many decades ago, I was in Bangladesh, and I went to a cholera clinic there. And, you know, cholera has the same manifestations where your bodily fluids get out of control and you know, it can kill you very quickly. But cholera was a bacteria-based, and the bacteria, if I understood this correctly, multiplied incredibly exponentially, and the waste from the bacteria that the bacteria produced were toxic to the system. So that's very clear. The system just went toxic, and you were losing fluids from everywhere. Why is this different from a common cold? What is the mechanism that causes your body to lose control?
Well, that's an excellent question, Jug, and it's one of those things that's a little bit hard to answer in a very simple way, because this is the mechanisms of action, as we would call it, of how Ebola specifically affects your body are very, very complex, and we're learning more about them as we go along. But essentially, the important thing to think about is, so Ebola is a virus, and the way that viruses work is that they have specialized areas on their surface that sort of dictate what cells they interact with in your body, and also can trigger parts of your immune system and other things such as circulating in your blood. And so by its action doing those and talking with these very tiny molecules that are the messengers, so things like if you were to read a scientific paper, you would see words like cytokines is one of the names for those. But it essentially causes these to produce some of the symptoms. It triggers your body to produce symptoms like fever. It has other ways that it interacts in terms of specific ways that it, as we mentioned before, essentially evades your immune system in terms of subverting and infecting certain immune system cells, avoiding having your body make an antibody response. And then the biggest thing in terms of thinking about fluid and such and the potential hemorrhagic complications are that it specifically goes to and affects the tiniest blood vessels in our body, the capillaries, and those are the things that it causes to leak and can potentially cause the bleeding complications. And hopefully that sounded like a satisfying answer, but it's a very interesting but very complex topic. There's a lot of things it does.
George in Anne Arundel County with a question akin to that. Go right ahead, George.
Thank you. I'm curious to know how this is different from, say, AIDS, where I understand that it requires an exchange of bodily fluids. So, for instance, if someone with AIDS had licked the arm of a person that didn't have any wound on their arm, then they wouldn't be infected. But if they exchanged saliva, let's say, through kissing, they would. So if Ebola is transmitted through bodily fluids, but it comes in contact with someone else's skin, does that still infect them so it somehow penetrates the skin?
That is an excellent question, and it brings up a very good point that some people have been discussing with the new CDC recommendations. As we mentioned before, the CDC now says the newest recommendations that just came out for protecting ourselves is that no ounce of skin That's actually the wrong unit of measure, for which I apologize. No area of skin should be exposed where previously there might have been areas that have been exposed. And so that's led some people to wonder, well, if the Ebola virus, if fluid with the Ebola virus in it were to get on my skin, does that mean I'm doomed? And the answer is no. If you have intact skin, it's not going to be absorbed in through your skin. However, if you were to get it on your skin and potentially have a cut or an abrasion so that it could potentially get into your lymphatic fluid or your blood, then it would be exposed to the rest of your body. And the thought with regards to not having the skin exposed is less that maybe someone might have a cut or an injury on their neck, but more that there's a higher chance of you accidentally brushing the fluid on your neck and then touching your eyes, your nose, your mouth, something like that. One quick fact point I will also make with regards to your comments with HIV is that actually HIV is not spread through saliva contact, just so that everyone is clear about that. It's exposure to blood or reproductive fluids. Certainly if somebody had a cut or a sore in their mouth, then maybe it could be spread that way. But just saliva to saliva, it doesn't work that way. But just thank you again for that question, though.
Dr. John Smarr with us for this hour of midday. If you have a question about Ebola, 410-662-8780. One of our listeners wanted us to be specific about the West African countries involved in this, especially as it pertains to the travel restrictions that are going into place starting on Monday. They are Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Maryland is among six states being asked to increase surveillance because about 70% of travelers from Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone are headed to those jurisdictions. Maryland because of, I guess, BWI and Dulles Airport just to our south in Virginia. The CDC is ordering Maryland health officials to monitor all the travelers entering the state from those countries for signs of Ebola. And, John, I noticed one of the things they're going to do is the travelers from those three countries will be given kits at the airport when they arrive, including a thermometer, a logbook for recording temperatures, and information on identifying potential Ebola symptoms. If a traveler does not check in with the local health department, authorities will take immediate steps to find the person. This is according to the CDC directive.
And the key there is that, of course, we're putting a lot of trust into self-reporting. So the goal here is that in no way, shape, or form do we have the personnel to physically go and directly monitor people. So it is the right thing to do, though, to have them check in. So I'll go back to the Nigeria situation, which, as we heard a few days ago, they are Ebola free.
Yeah.
Great news. And the other piece, though, is that when you look at Liberia and Sierra Leone, relatively speaking from a population standpoint, they're small countries compared with Nigeria. So those two countries together have about 10 million people in them. Nigeria has more like 170-ish million people. And the capital of Nigeria, Lagos, has about 10 million. So the capital city has as many people as are in those other two countries. And so they had more of an infrastructure when their cases were coming in. And the level of contact tracing that they went to, they actually had daily check-ins with everyone. And if someone, a potential contact, and these aren't sick people, these are people they're monitoring for potential contact.
Right,
if
right.
These people didn't check in, and at least in one case, the person tried to flee and hide, they went and they tracked them down. So that's slightly different than monitoring travelers coming into the U.S., but the message is that giving people this kit is great, but the best part about it is that requirement that they check in,
mm-hmm.
especially because there are cultural attitudes, we've talked about this before, with regards to people in that area and Ebola, that would lead to them not wanting to admit that as a very strong feeling that they have. And even we go back to the patient in Dallas, Mr. Duncan, the reports were that in terms of his screening form, when he was initially screened, he actually checked, no, I did not have contact with an Ebola patient. And so, again, this is self-reporting, and people may not answer truthfully for reasons to them that are very important. So the checking in piece to me is probably one of the most key aspects of that.
Let's take another call for John Smarr, Dr. Smarr. Jason in Baltimore, go right ahead with your question, please. Hi.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. I don't actually have a question. I have a comment. I'd like to point something out, and that is the healthcare system in America is far more advanced than what I know of any healthcare system in West Africa. And yes, it's scary that these people have come into the country and people have even people even in this country have contracted the Ebola virus. However, we've only had one death, whereas the survival rate in West Africa is, last I know, was 70%. And the bottom line is we are well equipped to handle this stuff. Now, obviously, we want to prevent it, but we are well equipped to handle the sort of treatment that needs to be given to anybody who has a severe viral infection, bacterial infection. And I think that's what people need to look at. It's scary, but we here in America, we could certainly handle this, get this under control. And I think that as of right now, there are a lot of people taking the right steps, with the exception of the hospital there in Texas. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that's a great comment, Jason. The one thing I would just I think I would not prefer the word advanced, and I would probably prefer the word less resources, because the doctors over there have been dealing with Ebola on the front lines for a heck of a lot longer than, of course, most 99% of the American doctors, and certainly no one who's ever been over there. And so it's not that they don't have the expertise. But it's more the infrastructure and the resources. So they have the knowledge. And again, advanced is kind of the right word, but I want to make the point that they have expertise. The people over there know what they're doing, but they're often in very challenging circumstances with regards to the amount of resources they have, with the cultural context, the social context of what's going on. But your point is very, very well taken in terms of our infrastructure here and why the chances are, of course, we may see other patients in the U.S. with Ebola, but the chances that with our current healthcare system, that would turn into a true outbreak in the United States seem very small.
Last week, a guest on our show, a Deputy Secretary of Health here in Maryland, I asked her the question about whether we would see designated hospitals to treat Ebola patients should anyone in the state contract the disease or show up here with the disease. And it wasn't clear whether that was going to happen, although that was something certainly being talked about. Now, we found out yesterday, John, that the health officials in Maryland have designated three hospitals to handle any Ebola cases in Maryland should they arrive: Johns Hopkins Hospital, the University of Maryland Medical Center here in Baltimore, then also the MedStar Washington Hospital Center in D.C. in the district. I guess you weren't surprised to see this designation.
Not at all, because it's not that we have the entire rationale for why these centers were chosen, but when you look at them, they're obviously big centers that have the most expertise in terms of an already a basis. And for instance, we mentioned Hopkins and Bloomberg earlier. Mm-hmm. A lot of these folks have international experience as well. Hospital Center is a huge medical center. It's very centrally located in D.C. And so the idea of designating centers that potentially have the most resources and the most space, this actually is seems very wise in terms of being able to sort of geographically isolate and funnel patients should any of them show up.
Let's take one more call before the next break. Melanie in Baltimore, go right ahead with your comment
or
question. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that what should not be lost in this discussion is the fact that the response might have been more centralized and more immediate if we had a Surgeon General, and that nomination has been blocked by Republicans because the nominee made a comment about the public health crisis that is gun violence in this country. And I think I would feel better if there was one centralized Surgeon General overseeing everything about this.
And I of course would too. I would like one of those. And one of the other pieces that one can't ignore in our discussion about Ebola is the fact it's happening during a political season. And as someone put it very well, that I saw, the party in power wants to assure everyone they're doing everything right. The party who is not in power wants to assure everyone that the party in power is doing nothing. And this type of conflict that's led to, as you noted, us not having a Surgeon General is, I think, problematic for a national effort. So that is a very good point, Melanie.
If you had asked me what the capital of Nigeria was, I would have said Lagos, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most populous city.
Most popular. Did I commit a factual error?
Yes,
what you're telling
and I want to
me.
Thank one of our listeners for tweeting in the correction.
Very
actually,
good.
I would have assumed Lagos, Nigeria was the capital. It's not. It's the most populated city, though. It's Abuja.
Abuja.
The federal capital territory of Nigeria is Abuja, A-B-U-J-A. See, you learn something here every
that's
day.
That's right. I apologize for my misstatement.
Of course, that's all right.
Absolutely.
Thank you, John. John Smarr with us for the remainder of the hour. And when we get back, we'll have hopefully a phone call from Liberia and Elizabeth Sirlamitsos of the Johns Hopkins Center for Communication Program. She's working on helping that country have a better public health communication system to deal with Ebola. So we'll get to that when we get back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Dr. John Smarr from Sinai Hospital, infectious disease specialist and a regular contributor to Midday and Midday on Health. And, John, I want to try to connect now to Elizabeth Sirlamitsos, who's in Liberia. She's with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and their Center for Communication Programs. And I thought it'd be interesting to speak with Elizabeth today about what she's working there on the ground. What she's working on there on the ground in Liberia. So, Elizabeth, are you there with us?
I am.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us on the Midday Show.
My pleasure.
Elizabeth, where are you exactly in Liberia? Are you in Monrovia?
I am in Monrovia. And actually, at the moment, I'm sitting at the Ebola Operations Center, which is kind of like the war room for the Ebola response here.
I'm very interested in the work you're doing over there. For the Center for Communication Programs at Hopkins. Tell us what you're working on. What is the nature of your project there?
Well, as the name says, the Center for Communication Programs focuses largely on communication and how we can use communication to help change harmful practices and bring about behavior change. But we also are focusing very heavily in this context on social mobilization and community engagement, so that collectively communities are taking ownership of the situation and most particularly of the response to the situation.
So are you helping people through radio stations, through social media? How are you doing this, Elizabeth? And what are you trying to do, get good information out about Ebola?
Exactly. And, you know, the information is evolving almost daily. And we are, as you said, using lots of different channels. There's a heck of a lot of really basic grassroots community mobilizing as well through any and every kind of social group available in a community. It could be a women's group, a faith-based group, a youth group, and so forth. So people are being engaged at all levels. And as you pointed out, we're also using radio, which has quite a wide coverage here. Social media to some extent, cell phone technology. We also are helping strengthen the hotline. There's an Ebola, it's called the call center here, an Ebola hotline where people can call both for basic information, counseling support, but also to report if they have a case, a patient in their home, or perhaps if they've had a death in the family and they can get help to deal with that problem. So, you know, strengthening up and down the whole chain.
You know, Liberia had gone through a civil war not that long ago. So I wondered, was one of the difficulties here or one of the challenges having sort of a central clearinghouse of information, a central source of accurate information about Ebola treatment, where the outbreak's occurring, what people should do?
Yeah, as I said, you know, the information that needs to be provided to people is an evolving process. And of course, early in the outbreak, the main message was kind of Ebola is real, because a lot of people were doubting and so forth. And now that message is pretty well come across, we're focusing much more on some of the behavioral stuff. And the Ministry of Health, I think, Day is releasing the message guide, which will be updated probably on a fortnightly basis with whatever the newest, most important messages are. And right now, the main three messages are about hand washing and hygiene, which, of course, is a great practice under any circumstances. But also the message around if you have a patient or a deceased member of your family, call 4455, which is the hotline number to get help, or ask your community leader for help. And there's a number of ambulances that have been mobilized, and ambulances will go to the home, or a burial team will go to the home. They'll also go with a case investigation team that will be followed up with contact tracing. And there's a third message that's escaping me at the moment.
That's okay.
Oh, about not touching any of the body fluids or personal items of anyone who's sick or has died.
Elizabeth, Dr. John Smarr is with us from Sinai Hospital. He had a question for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Hi, Elizabeth, John. Thank you so much for calling in. It's great.
Hi, John.
It's great to hear from someone out there. So one of the things that, of course, we were talking about earlier was the challenges with communication and accurate information. And one curiosity I had was, have you been able to gauge how effective the communication is? Because obviously you've designed an excellent message, but do you feel like you're gaining ground? Do you have any sort of comment on how you feel your success has been and how you've responded to that?
I've only been here a couple of weeks, and early when I arrived, I was in one of the meetings where there was a briefing from a group that is working up in one of the counties towards the north, which is called LOFA, and the report was coming back that really the situation in LOFA seems to have kind of turned around, and everybody was attributing it to the community engagement and local leadership. And certainly I think that aspect of the message in LOFA came through very strongly, that those leaders in that community took ownership of the problem and decided on the interventions that were going to be best suited for them to achieve, you know, the behavioral objectives, and that has greatly reduced incidence of Ebola in that county. So that was so heartening when I had sort of just arrived and wasn't really sure what to expect, to feel like things are starting to maybe turn around. And that's not to say the job is done, because it's still an enormous task, but to know that communities can get engaged and can take control of the situation in their environment.
Elizabeth Sirlamitzo speaking to us from Monrovia, Liberia. She's there for the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health Center for Communication Programs. Elizabeth, maybe we can check in with you again after another week or so.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you for your time today and for the work you're doing.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to have you with us. So we should check in with her again, find out. I meant to ask her how long she planned to be there on that project, but we'll get back to her. Mm-hmm. Thank you, John. Let's take a couple more calls for John Smarr as we round out the hour here. A question from Maria in Randallstown for John. Go right ahead, Maria.
Yes. My question is to Dr. John Smarr about how safe to fly from New York to South Carolina? My daughter had to go on business trip, and I'm concerned as a mother.
I completely understand your concern, Maria, and you know the best way I could answer that is that if I was in New York and I had to get to South Carolina, I would fly. I would have absolutely no concerns about that. However, I would be disingenuous if I didn't say that I was paying a little bit more of extra attention to anyone around me who seemed ill. And I think that that is very sensible advice for anyone traveling. But I would have zero concerns at this point for, say, flying from New York to South Carolina.
Let's take another call for John. Rena in Baltimore. Go right ahead with your question.
Oh, thank you. I've been in the radio, John. I didn't realize. Excuse me. I have so many questions, because everything that's been going on is so interesting. When everybody's calls were things that I was thinking. So, personally, the thing I'm most interested in, you know, for myself, it would be contagion. And I'm really glad that George asked the exact question about four callers back about contact, because I was confused, because we have these really seemingly intelligent people who know about the disease, that they're working and coming home and, you know, like doctors who got the disease and those nurses. And it is confusing that just like what's wrong with having the neck exposed. And I appreciate that that Dr. Smarr gave us a good explanation of that. But what confuses me is how long. Okay, so let's say my neck was exposed and some little bit minuscule bodily fluid touched it and I couldn't even see it, and it probably dries in a minute or two, even if it's there. How long is, you know, if 2 hours later I happen to touch that spot, and then put my hand in my mouth. I mean, is it still contagious?
That's actually an excellent question. Thank you, Rena. And the answer has to do with the fact that the virus itself is of a type of virus that's very sensitive to being killed by a couple of things. One is light, specifically certain wavelengths of UV light, and the other is drying. And so if you are, so that this plays into thinking about how you would contaminate, how you would decontaminate a room if someone who was an Ebola patient who was in there, it plays into thinking about exposures. One of the challenges with regards to if it gets on someone's skin, if you're thinking about a healthcare worker, is that if you're in these suits, it's very hot. You're sweating a lot. And so even, and you're likely working for hours in a row. So your skin is going to be very moist. And if you're thinking about the general public, if your skin is particularly moist and the, let's say, a tiny spritz of fluid that's infected gets on, say, your neck, it's kind of hard to answer the question of how long. But the answer would be is that if that area of fluid dries and your skin is dry and you're exposed to the sunlight, I would say that 2 hours later, that the level of risk doesn't seem like it would be that appreciable. But simultaneously, it's hard to guarantee those conditions. And if you were sweating or you had, or your skin was very moist or you were in a darker area, then it might last for long. And this gets into why for healthcare workers now, one of the things the CDC is recommending is that if you've dealt with an Ebola patient, once you appropriately take off all of your protective equipment, you have someone who's helping you do that, you have someone observing you to make sure everything's okay, that you should actually just go and take a shower afterwards. So it's not just that you've taken off everything and you're done. You perform hand hygiene, you wash your hands repeatedly, but that also showering is another good precaution.
I can see why people traveling in a plane, on a train, in a bus would be concerned about something like that. Because, I mean, if someone coughs heavily, like you said, or sneezes or something like that, you don't even know if this matter is touching you. It could be, maybe not. But I can see why in close quarters people would have extra concern about why Maria's call and what Rena was getting at there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's go to Eric in Northeast Baltimore with your question. Please be quick, Eric.
Yes. Dr. Smar, I was wondering if you could discuss the sexual transmission of Ebola and whether there's any reason to think that it doesn't follow all of the same rules. I heard Diane Rehm wonder aloud about the New York doctor's whether he might have, you know, transmitted it to his fiance or something like that before he became symptomatic. I wonder if you could discuss that.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. That's an important question, because when people go through Ebola, you want to figure out how, even afterwards, how is it that you can return to your normal daily lives and doing the normal activities that you're used to, affection with your loved ones and such. So there's not a lot of studied published data on this topic. We do know that there have been people that they have actually isolated viable Ebola virus from their reproductive fluids, in this case semen, 2, maybe 3 months after they recovered. So actually one of the things that they tell folks once they've recovered is, hi, here's, be sure that you're practicing safe sex. There is no officially confirmed documented case of sexual transmission. We know for sure that it was sexual transmission of Ebola, but it raises it as a potential possibility. And it's an interesting thing to talk about in terms of someone who's just getting sick, like you just said. The thought would be that at that point, the level of the virus sort of in the body hasn't gotten to the point where it's highly concentrated in the semen, but that's a question that so I would say it's probably less likely, but we just don't have enough knowledge to be able to say for sure.
Before I let you go, John, how do you think we're doing overall with this as a country, as a nation, in terms of trying to contain this?
I think overall we as a nation are doing a good job, because what this is doing is it's forcing hospitals with different levels of preparedness to elevate themselves, making ourselves aware of it, doing all the basic stuff better, and that's a good thing.
John Smart joins us once a month for Midday on Health, but he'll be back again soon to talk some more about this ongoing story of Ebola and some other viruses that are going around. We didn't get to John, but John will be back. John's an infectious disease specialist based at Sinai Hospital and joins us here from time to time on Midday. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning into our first hour. Please stick around for the second hour coming up just just shortly. We take a break now for lunch provided every Friday by Joe Squared Pizza. Joe Squared is located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood and at the Inner Harbor at Power Plant Live. And you can find them on the web at joesquared.com. Thank you, Joe Squared, for lunch. Please stay tuned for the news, and then we'll see you for the second hour of our show.
Midday continues at 1 o'clock here on WYPR. Be sure to stay with us at 2 o'clock for Science Friday.
It took more than Steve Jobs to make a computer revolution. I'm Ira Flatto. On the next Science Friday, Walter Isaacson tells the story of the hundreds of innovators who made the digital age. Also, the internet pioneer who sent the first message on the first computer network born 45 years ago. All on Science Friday from PRI.